twice. Men say only fools rush in.
Thank you. Hey, don't laugh now.
But I can't help falling in love with you. Shall I stay?
Before you get ready for the next round of Hide and Clap, you really ought to listen to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who had a terrifying premonition that this podcast was going to be haunted.
Mike DiCriscio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I'm interested in what things you have to say about Conjuring 2 today.
And I am interested in what you have to say as well, Mike. And that is why we have a podcast where we get to hear each other's opinions about the movies that we're going to be reviewing.
Mm, that makes a lot of sense. It's all coming together now.
I was wondering why we were doing this for the last year and a half.
Yeah, I thought it was just a thing. I didn't know that we were actually supposed to be engaged with each other.
Wait, are we recording this? if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, essentially we start with some film news and then move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we'll move on to our featured review. This week we are reviewing the new film from director James Wan and the sequel to 2013's The Conjuring, The Conjuring 2.
I was trying to think of The Conjuring, but I couldn't do it.
The Conjurosin.
What?
Two Conjuring, Two Furious.
There it is. That's
the one. Two Conjuring, Two Furious.
Two Con, Two Juring.
And that connects it back to James Wan's previous film, Furious 7.
Which we love.
Which we did love. So there is that. Actually, and James Wan knows you love it because he responded to you on Twitter recently.
We're pals, pals now.
Yeah, best buds. Mike DiCriscio and James Wan. You hear it here first.
Yep.
Mike's best friends with James Wan and Elizabeth Olsen.
That's right.
It's really quite remarkable.
I touch all the big movie franchises.
All right. Let's get into some film news, Mike.
Sure. That's a good idea.
It's time for
All right, it's time for film news, and we had quite a few things to get through this week, the first of which, a few months ago, we talked about Rob Marshall being hired to direct a sequel to Mary Poppins for Disney, and that's actually coming together now. It's kind of coming together. It's going to be released on Christmas 2018. It's going to be called Mary Poppins Returns, and it's going to star Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda.
So that's going to make every dollar.
There won't be any dollars left.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Because of all the dollars that Mary Poppins Returns gets. Yeah, this is going to be... I mean, first off, Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins, I think it's, phenomenal casting. I'm not even a fan of Mary Poppins, really, but, that's, I'm not a fan of Mary Poppins, but it's one of those... I'm a very indifferent person towards Mary Poppins.
There you go.
But Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins, it makes me excited to see it. That's a great casting choice. And also, Lin-Manuel Miranda...
I mean, he can't do wrong at this point.
He's the darling of the internet. I've been obsessed with Hamilton for maybe 3 months now. I got the soundtrack a while ago, and I'm at a point where I can pretty much recite the entire thing from memory if you wanted me to.
I mean, if we had the time.
If we had the time, it's just...
We're contractually obligated.
You got to ask yourself, how does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore, and a Scotsman...
Nope, stop it.
But yeah, that's really exciting. Lin-Manuel Miranda is breaking into the pop culture in a big way. I mean, Hamilton just won every Tony.
Yeah, pretty much.
Including the ones it wasn't nominated for. It
still won, though.
It was actually... Did you see any of the Tonys, Mike?
I did not, actually.
Okay, I got to see some of it. I watched the first hour, and then I switched over to Game of Thrones, and then I watched some of the rest before I went to bed, because I wanted to see Hamilton perform. But it was the show opened up with a Hamilton parody. And then Hamilton had a big opening. And then it closed, it had its big number. Every show that's nominated gets to perform. And then it closed, Hamilton won the award, and then it closed with another performance from Hamilton.
Jesus.
Yeah. It was, for Hamilton fans,
Hamilton is everything.
Yeah, so. It's great. It's I mean, it's really phenomenal. Like, I don't need to tell people that Hamilton is great. It doesn't need any more press from me.
I don't know, Mike. You're the voice of the people, though.
Well, that's true. People's champion, they call me. Speaking of the people's champion, Lin-Manuel Miranda is writing the songs for Disney's Mona, starring the people's champion, The Rock.
Wow. That's why they pay you the big bucks.
I'm bringing this back around. But yeah, that's coming out later this year, the new animated movie that Lin-Manuel Miranda is writing the songs for.
Yeah, actually, the new teaser trailer they put out, I watched despite my anti-trailer stance.
Really?
And it looks really cool.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda is, like, blowing up in this huge thing now. I know he's leaving Hamilton in July, but he's going to be basically working in movies. Like, he's going to be – they're doing an In the Heights musical movie now.
Right.
As well. And presumably at some point, I imagine a Hamilton movie will happen.
Yeah, I mean, it can't not at this point.
Right. It's such, like, a cultural phenomenon. Like, it's crazy that it's not, like, already being made into a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's very exciting. I think he's, like, just a really incredible talent, and I'm excited to see what more stuff he's got going on in the future, because we're going to get a lot of it.
Yeah, he's going to be everywhere. We're
going to get a lot of Lin-Manuel Miranda in the future. I was watching Comedy Bang Bang, the new TV show. The new season started recently, by the way. Okay. It's great. Weird Al Yankovic's the new band leader. It's awesome.
Perfect.
And John Mulaney and Nick Kroll were on as their characters from Oh Hello.
Okay.
And they were talking about because they did a Broadway show for like a month or two. And they were talking about Lin-Manuel Miranda and Hamilton. And they're like, yeah, Lin-Manuel Miranda thinks he's hot shit on Broadway just because he has the only popular show.
That's awesome.
But, you know, we like to tell ourselves, We're Lin-Manuel Carey Bradshaws, and he's such a Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's such a good joke. I hate it. I hate it so much.
But anyway, enough about Lin-Manuel Miranda and Emily Blunt. They're doing Mary Poppins Returns. I do think it's coming together pretty well. Rob Marshall directing it. You know, whatever, we'll see. But
yeah. If there's one thing that would make me go from like meh to like oh, it's that casting choice.
Yeah, exactly.
About this movie.
Yeah, so that's pretty wild. And then also Rick Famuyiwa, who is the director of the movie Dope, which came out last year, is going to be directing The Flash for DC. Now, a while ago, we talked about The Flash losing its director Seth Graham Smith, and that was, I think, shortly after Batman v Superman came out. So it seemed like there's a lot of like tumultuousness going on in DC, and we've talked about that in the past too. And you know, there were rumors that James Wan might be leaving Aquaman and all this right. kind of crazy stuff. But The Flash seems to be back on track, and the fact that Rick Famuyiwa is directing it is kind of encouraging, because I saw Dope, and Dope's pretty like it's a
pretty
fun.
Dope.
Shut up. It's but it's a pretty fun movie. Like, it's not like dour like Batman v Superman is, you know.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I haven't seen Dope, but from what I've heard, that's kind of the take that a lot of people have from it. So that's good. And from what I've seen of trailers and on Netflix and stuff, it seems pretty bright and vibrant and colorful, which is something that they need.
Yeah, and especially for The Flash, I feel like that would work very well.
Right.
I mean, the Flash TV show has been on for 2 years, and this season was darker than the previous season, but it was still relatively lighthearted, and you know, this I feel like if it can kind of maintain what the show is doing but also be its own thing, which I know doesn't make any sense, but that's what I want, so that's yeah. what's
fair enough.
Yeah. So I just wanted to bring that up because I think that's pretty interesting. Also, we've known for a while that Kevin Smith was doing a sequel to Mallrats.
Yes.
Right. And he's on the promotional tour right now for his new movie Yoga Hosers, which I guess you haven't seen the trailer for that.
No, I haven't.
It looks bananas. And
okay.
Like, I don't know if that's in a good way or not, but
time will tell.
Time will tell. It's going to be interesting to say the least. There's actually a reference to Clerks in the trailer for Yoga Hosers. Actually, speaking of the trailer for Yoga Hosers, I do just want to point out there was one hilarious bit where it's saying like, you know, from the guys who did this, from the guys, and yeah. from human hockey jersey, Kevin Smith.
That's awesome.
Which I thought was a great descriptor for Kevin Smith.
It is. Pretty accurate.
Anyway, he's been putting together a sequel to Mallrats for a while. He's been calling it Mallbrats. And, you know, for a while he was getting the cast together and it was like this big thing and it seemed like he was going to be shooting very soon. I guess they hit kind of a snag with that, but it's still on track to happen. But now, instead of a movie, Mallrats 2 is going to be a 10-episode TV series.
I just have no idea how to feel about that.
I mean, if there's anything Kevin Smith movies needed, it's to be more long-winded, am I right?
Yes, that's right. That's definitely what it is. We need longer conversations.
Yeah, I don't know about this. I mean, I do like Kevin Smith, and I am interested in Mallrats 2, because I am a fan of Mallrats. But at the same time, I feel like there's not that much there for a TV series. Like, I don't know what you can do with that. He's talked about the plot to Mallrats 2, and he said it would be like Die Hard in the mall. Right, I think we talked about that when we were doing Comic-Con. And I don't know if there's 10 episodes worth of material there.
Right. That plot doesn't seem to lend itself to a TV show. Like, I don't know what this could be.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And Smith has recently been going into TV. He's actually producing a new TV show based on The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. The cult 80s movie starring Peter Weller.
Yes.
He's producing a new TV show based on that. And I guess they have a network now, so that's actually happening. And he tried to do a movie called Hit Somebody for a while, and that was going to be based on a Warren Zevon song, and it was like a hockey movie. And that ended up not happening. But originally, that was going to be a movie, and then it turned into like two movies, and then it turned into a miniseries, and it never happened. But but the
so
plan...
this may not bode well for Mallrats 2, is what you're saying.
It might not. You know, we'll see what happens. I mean, Smith is like super busy now. Like, I mean, he's working on a lot of stuff all the time now. Like, as opposed to a couple of years ago, he was talking about retiring. You know, now he's like just decided, like, nope, not retiring anymore. I'm just going to make a bunch of movies. See what sticks.
Do everything.
Yeah. And that resulted in Tusk, which, did you see Tusk?
No, I never got around to it.
It is something. I saw Tusk once in theaters, and I genuinely don't know. I still, to this day, do not know whether I liked it or not. Like, I'm still like it's just such like a perplexing movie that exists. Like,
yep, that happened.
I'm a little afraid that Yoga Hoser is going to be the same deal.
Right.
Just because it's based in the same universe as Tusk. It's like based on two characters who were in Tusk.
Yeah, he's doing like the Canadian trilogy or something like that?
The True North trilogy.
Yeah.
So he's doing that and then he's following it up with Moose Jaws.
That's what it is, yeah.
Which should be interesting. At least Yoko Hoser does have Jason Mewes in it. You know, so that's something. You know, speaking of Kevin Smith doing TV, actually, he did direct an episode of The Flash this season.
Really?
And it was actually great. Like, it was one of the best episodes. So, and Jason Mewes had a cameo in that as well. So.
There we go.
So there was that. And finally, Warcraft is a movie that came out this past weekend to very little fanfare, I feel like. It opened like number 3 at the box office here. It is doing monster business overseas. I mean, it's breaking records all over the place.
Yeah. Except here.
Except in America. And it's kind of crazy. Like, I guess I had no idea how popular World of Warcraft was.
Right. Yeah, it's a weird, because there's actually a lot of games involved in the Warcraft franchise
like
and story.
Year,
it's not
20 years worth of games, right?
Yeah, they've been around for a long time. I haven't seen the movie, and I don't really know a whole lot about. You know, I never played WoW or anything. But so it seems like there would be a crazy amount of hype. But then I guess when people reviews were coming out that like it's not really that great, I think, like, I don't really know, but everywhere else they love it. So I don't know if it's because Warcraft has a 20-year history and is much more popular other places than
it's
in the US.
Quite possible. I mean, it got like the highest grossing opening weekend in China, like, of all time. Beating movies like Furious 7 and The Force Awakens, like.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I wonder if that's a product of China as a film market being relatively new.
Possibly. I think it's also kind of an indication that studios are less and less reliant on American box office, you know, to fund their movies. And you know, that's something that has been kind of happening for a while. Like, yeah. You'll see, like, Pacific Rim 2 is happening, and the only reason it's happening is because it did fairly well overseas.
Yeah.
And it got great reviews. Like, Pacific Rim mostly got good reviews. But in America, it bombed the box office. Like, it didn't do well, and overseas it did pretty well.
Right.
This is a movie that did not get good reviews, for the most part. Warcraft got, like, a 23 in Rotten Tomatoes. And in America, it's not doing well. But it's doing so well overseas that people are talking like there might be a sequel to Warcraft. Like, it might happen.
Just based on overseas box office.
Yeah. It's entirely possible. And if that's the case, then it feels like America is finally, like as a dominant... Like, it's still going to be a dominant part of film culture, but it's, I think, much smaller than it used to be.
Right.
If that's the case.
Yeah, that would make sense.
That's pretty wild. But that's it for film news today. I just wanted to bring up that stuff. Still Lin-Manuel Miranda, man. I'm just very excited to see more of him. I think he's really good. Really good talent. Yeah. All right, enough of that. Let's move on to our discussions.
These are my discussions.
Just when I thought I could talk about movies all day, I talked about more, so we're going to talk about them today.
These are my discussions.
There is so much to see you and me, so we're going to talk about movies for our
discussions.
All right, let's get into our discussions for today's film bookcast. You know, maybe Lin-Manuel Miranda could be in World of Warcraft 2.
In which case...
And then American box office, that'll spike. It'll spike right up.
Definitely.
You know, also it should be a musical.
Yeah, clearly.
About the founding fathers of the Warcraft world, Azeroth.
I would watch it.
Azeroth Hamilton.
There it is.
I think Azeroth is the name of the land and not any character.
In the Azeroth is what it's going to be.
In the Azeroth. In the Heights joke.
There it is.
Most people would make a Hamilton joke, but you zigged where you could have zagged.
Oh, man.
That's why we do this podcast.
That's right.
All right, Mike, what's your discussion for today?
So my discussion is not going to be great. I'm going to talk about the one episode of Lady Dynamite that I have watched.
Okay. Go for it. Tell me your thoughts on this one episode of Lady Dynamite.
My well-researched and thought-out thoughts. Well, I saw everyone was in love with Lady Dynamite. You've talked to me about it a couple, about what a genius and refreshing show it was. And I'll grant you that it is that. It has all those things going for it. But for some reason, not a whole lot of it landed for me. There's a lot of weird, I guess, visual jokes.
Stuff. Yeah.
But it is a really unique take on the stand-up comedian having their own sitcom. And they make jokes about that in the whole show. Is, oh my god, this has been done before.
Right.
Patton Oswalt will be playing a character, and then they'll mention her stand-up show later that night, and then he's like, okay, we got it. Wait a second, hold on. And he, like, stops the show. And that stuff was really funny to me, calling attention to the tropes and... I can't think of the word. Mike, help.
I don't know what word you're looking for, man. did the Breaking Bad reference make you laugh, at least?
Wait, what? I don't think I even remember it.
There's...
Oh, with the play with the color palette?
No, Patton Oswalt says something a lot like... There's a scene in the first episode. Patton Oswalt's explaining to Maria, like, you know, audiences are smarter than you give them credit for. You don't have to have a laugh track. You don't have to do stand-up on your show. You can mess around with the form, do different things narrative-wise. Did you see Breaking Bad? People love that. And she's like, oh, no, I didn't see it. And he's like, oh, well, you gotta see it. Because it's this thing where you, like, mess around with the form, do, like, random stuff, and then it immediately smash cuts to the pink teddy bear floating in water.
Yes, I do remember that now. Yeah, that stuff was great. Things like that were hilarious. Mark McGrath is in it, and he's, like, a major plot point, which is bizarre. Right. Which was awesome. But I think just... It was things, the other stuff besides them calling attention to the show, making fun of that, like, tropes and all that stuff. None of the other things landed for me. But granted, like I said, I only watched one episode.
Okay.
So I'm sure if I kept going or gave it a second chance, it would actually be funny for me.
Yeah, but I'm gonna speak from my expert perch of having watched 3 episodes.
There it is.
And I'm a big fan. I really like it. I'm excited to watch the rest of it. Yeah, it's just so different than everything else that's airing right now. It's starring Maria Bamford and created by Mitch Hurwitz, who's the creator of Arrested Development. And it's kind of like a huge mesh of those two comedic sensibilities, I think.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of like really oddball humor, like very like narratively disconnected. A lot of it's told in flashbacks or flash forwards. And it's just a like jokes. There's no continuity between jokes, like stuff that'll happen earlier in the episode will have no bearing on what happens later on and vice versa. Right. But so much of it is so funny. And I do think it's a little bit messy, but it's, I think kind of, it owns its messiness and it kind of reflects the protagonist in its own way.
That's definitely true.
There's an episode 3 I thought was amazing. And it's this episode where she's trying to be a white person, understanding how to deal with racism. You know, because she does a TV show in that episode with the Lucas brothers, the two black comedians. Uh-huh. And she's doing everything she can to help them represent their race in a positive light. Because when the show first starts out, like, they're garbage men, and like, but they're the stars of the show. They're like the ones making jokes and stuff, and they're upset about it because they just want to be fun. They just want to be comedians. They just want to be funny. And like, the screenwriter of 12 Years a Slave comes out, John Ridley.
Oh my God.
And starts explaining like, why what Maria is doing is harmful. And she's like, oh wow. Yeah. We solved racism forever. Thanks. And she like, runs off. And it's stuff like that, that I just found really funny. And, I forget the actor's name, but he played Cy Abelman in A Serious Man, her manager. I think he's hilarious in it. Like Bruce Ben Bacharach is the manager's name, I think.
Yeah, that's the character, yeah.
Yeah, but he is hilarious. And Anna Gasteyer as her agent is also fantastic. And
I'm just
on board for the show. Like, I think it's hilarious. And there's just great, like, comedic cameos throughout every episode. Like, in that first episode, you have, like, Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, John Mulaney. John Mulaney showing up in a Revolutionary War outfit, I thought was the best.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
And that's a joke that, like, I didn't get at first.
There's a joke there besides him just being dressed up?
Because the thing is, Patton Oswalt shows up in a police officer's uniform.
Right.
And then later on, Brian Posehn shows up in a police officer's uniform, but it's a much more, like, raggedy version, and it's, like, one that he had to make himself.
Yeah, and they make that joke.
They make that joke. It's like, you didn't give me a notice. I had to, like, throw something together. And so later, John Mulaney shows up in, like, a soldier's uniform, like an officer's uniform from the Revolutionary War, as if that's, like, a continuation of that joke. Like, that's what he threw together.
Oh, my God.
So it is a lot like Arrested Development, I think, where, like, I think on the rewatch, like, I'm really enjoying it now, but on the rewatch, I think the jokes are going to be even better because you get them, like, it takes you a couple viewings to get it.
Yeah. There's your 3 episode and your 1 episode review.
Yeah. Maybe when I watch 6 episodes, I'll come back and talk about more. I go through my shows very slowly. So
we'll see. It's fine.
Let's see what happens. I'm still crawling through Daredevil.
Wow.
Even though I'm enjoying it, like I like it a lot more than season 1. I'm on episode 11, I think. So I'm getting there.
You're almost there.
Yeah. But I'm not here to talk about Daredevil, Mike. I'm here to talk about a couple movies for my discussions.
Nailed it.
Yeah. First movie I want to talk about is a movie called Turbo Kid, which is available on Netflix now. And this is a terrific pastiche of, like, 80s pop culture. Gleefully violent in very creative ways. It's heavily influenced by, like, dystopian sci-fi, but also by superheroes, swashbuckling adventures, exploitation movies. Like, it's kind of just, like, cinema, like, condensed into one, like, any kind of genre cinema kind of condensed into one movie.
Okay.
And it's pretty fantastic. It's about this kid who grew up in the wasteland. It's, like, this dystopian world, and his parents are dead, and he's been scavenging on his own for years. And he meets this girl, and he teams up with her, and she turns out to be a robot. And the two of them have to take down Michael Ironside's character, who is basically, like, Immortan Joe of that universe. And Michael Ironside's character is also the guy who killed his parents. And
what a twist.
It's pretty fantastic. It's basically Mad Max meets Mega Man.
Wow.
I would say. Because basically, this kid is obsessed with superheroes. He's obsessed with this character named Turbo Man, who's like a comic book character. And he finds a Turbo Man outfit that he puts on and has like a functioning laser cannon.
Okay. Of course it does.
Yeah. Which is why I say it's like Mad Max meets Mega Man.
Yeah.
And it's genuinely one of the most violent movies I've ever seen.
Wow.
And I've seen quite a few. there's just some amazingly creative kills in this movie. There's one part where a guy is still alive, but his stomach is cut open and his intestines are tied to like a buzzsaw.
What the fuck?
And the buzzsaw is just going slowly, and like the guy has like a torture device.
Yeah,
it's like, I'll tell you everything you need to know. Just put him back, and they're like, that can't happen. Like, what are you talking about? And then they just speed up the buzzsaw, and he dies. There's a lot of stuff like that, and it's just some really great violent imagery in this movie that I thought was great. And Michael Ironside's villain is gloriously over the top, and it's just a lot of fun. If you're a fan of heavy violence, or the '80s, or synthesizer soundtracks, this is a movie for you. Also, I saw Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping, this past week, and it is fantastic. I'm a huge Lonely Island fan, have been since Andy Samberg first arrived in SNL. That was actually the first season of SNL I watched live, was when Andy Samberg joined the cast. And I have a very distinct memory of watching Lazy Sunday for the first time when it aired, and being obsessed with it. I had DVR'd that episode, I watched it live, and then... I remember it was the episode with Jack Black hosting, and like it was a great episode overall, but Lazy Sunday really stood out to me, because I was just like, this is next level stuff. This is fantastic. And Popstar is hilarious. It's perfectly skewering celebrity culture and modern pop figures like Justin Bieber. The original songs are so great, and it is filled with like amazing cameos and jokes. I don't want to say like who's in it, because there's a lot, but I don't want to like spoil any surprises, because it's fantastic. Yeah. This movie bombed at the box office.
Somehow I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it was kind of disappointing. I thought it might do a little better, because Lonely Island is kind of like a well-known name at this point.
Yeah.
But it's, Lonely Island also directed Hot Rod, which was similarly acclaimed. I don't know if critically it did that well when it first came out, but people have come around on it now. I remember Hot Rod. I had to drive like an hour to go see Hot Rod when that came out in theaters. Like,
wow. That's more commitment than anyone has ever had.
I know. But I love Hot Rod. I loved Hot Rod. It was great. And, The Lonely Island made Hot Rod, and Yoram Mitsukone from Lonely Island directed MacGruber, which is another movie that's also bombed, but is beloved by many.
Mostly you.
Mostly me. MacGruber has its fans. There are dozens of us. This time Popstar got really good reviews. Like, people were really on board with Popstar. And even so, it opened at like eighth place or something. Just a disaster. But at the same time, the budget wasn't that much. It was like $20 million, and I think it's going to be like a cult classic. Like, people are going to discover this movie later. It's going to be one of those movies that I end up buying on Blu-ray and forcing people to watch.
Yes, that's got that. This movie has that written all over it.
Yeah. So I just wanted to bring that up, because this movie is fantastic. I loved it. And seriously, all the music is so good. Have you heard any of the songs from Popstar, Mike?
I have not, no.
Okay. One of them aired as a digital short on SNL during its finale this year. It's called Finest Girl, the Bin Laden song.
Oh, my God.
And it's amazing. It's I think, like, one of the best songs. But in any case... those are our discussions for this week. I just wanted to get those out there. And now let's move on to our featured review, Mike, of The Conjuring 2.
This is my home. Get out now.
No, this is not your house. Now, what's your name?
My name is Bill Wilkins, and I'm 72 years old.
What do you make of that voice?
Sounds confused. Is he senile?
The voice on this tape is coming from an 11-year-old girl. They're calling it England's Amityville. There is a family that desperately needs our help.
After everything we've seen, There isn't much that rattles either of us anymore. But this one still haunts me. Does it feel like the voice is coming from inside you?
More like it's coming from behind me. Like I'm being used.
Janet, are you all right?
Stop calling me Janet.
She's such a good girl. What's it wrong with her?
An oppressing spirit will try to force you to commit the ultimate sin.
And what's that?
Murder? Suicide? Or both?
All right, that was from the trailer for The Conjuring 2. It's the new film from director James Wan, written by James Wan, Chad Hayes, Carrie Hayes, and David Leslie Johnson. It stars Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson, reprising their roles from the first movie, Frances O'Connor, Madison Wolf, Sinéad McBurney, and Franca Potente, among others. And Franca Potente, I haven't seen a movie in a while, but she was Lola in Run, Lola, Run.
Right, yeah.
And also she was in the Bourne movies as well, the first two, I think.
I think she's in the second one, mostly.
Yeah. Or,
yeah.
Yes. Anyway, the IMDb plot synopsis of The Conjuring 2. Lorraine and Ed Warren travel to North London to help a single mother raising four children alone in a house plagued by malicious spirits. So the original Conjuring, I think, like, I was thinking about this, and like, The Conjuring, I think the first one, is probably my favorite studio-released horror film of this decade so far. Like,
yes.
I just think that movie was fantastic. I remember coming out of that and being like, wow, kind of blown away by it. I love the way that James Wan directs these movies. You know,
yeah.
He's, you know, like, I wasn't a big fan of Insidious when that came out, although I haven't seen it since, and I would like to go back and rewatch it because I'm such a big fan of these Conjuring movies. But to me, the Insidious movies were kind of heavily reliant on jump scares. And The Conjuring, while it has those, is much more heavily built on atmosphere and,
yeah.
You know, kind of classical horror techniques that I think work a lot better for this kind of franchise. What was your... take on the original Conjuring, Mike, and your relationship with that movie?
It's kind of what you said. That I think it might be my favorite horror movie, like you said, of the last decade or so.
Favorite studio released.
Studio released.
Yeah. I'm not counting The Babadook because that's my favorite.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point.
The Babadook is aces.
We'll talk about. But
I know exactly what you're going to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, how could you not? But Conjuring, the first one, blew me away. I love hate every second of it.
Right. I mean, you, I feel like you have a very weird relationship with horror movies, Mike.
I do. It's so awful, but also it's the best.
See, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. I watch a lot of horror movies. I love the genre. And so I've seen a lot. I mean, are you somebody who watches a lot of horror movies, or are you just kind of like,
I think I go through waves, like where I do go through and I love and I dissect a lot of horror movies, and it's a lot of fun.
Right.
But then other times they really affect me. Like the first Conjuring, I'll be honest, messed me up. Like it really got to me and it hit me real hard. Like and Babadook as well. I've actually I haven't finished that movie still.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. Actually, cause I've watched a lot of horror movies, and I've been at a point for many years now where it's very difficult for them to like really, really rattle me, like really scare me.
Yeah.
The Babadook really got me. Like I watched a lot of times when I watch a horror movie, I'll try to watch it like with the lights off and like alone or whatever.
Right.
I did that with the Babadook and I had to turn my lights on like halfway through. Cause I was like, I can't do this.
Can't do it. Yeah.
This is like
Babadook is another one. I made it halfway, or I think a half hour or 45 minutes in or so, and I was like, I can't, I need someone here with me, I can't do it, I'm out. Because this isn't a Babadook review.
But the Babadook is great.
It's amazing and really, it has a really fucked up premise that really resonated and got to me. but Conjuring I loved, I remember really liking Insidious and being scared a lot. but I haven't seen it since then, like a similar situation to what you said. So I don't really remember everything about it.
Okay.
But that said, I don't know if we want to jump into Conjuring 2.
Yeah, I mean, do what you got to do. Say your piece.
I feel like Conjuring 2 is a very silly take to Conjuring, or like as compared to what the first Conjuring was.
Okay.
I feel like The Conjuring, the first one, I haven't seen that in a while. So I may just be misremembering it because I was scared and it like got to me. I feel like dealt with what the movie was in a very much, much more serious and like straight ahead horror. And Conjuring 2 to me felt like James Wan doing the Sam Raimi playbook.
Right. I also felt like a lot of Sam Raimi there's a lot of Sam Raimi DNA in this movie.
Yeah. Like down to this, like visual gags that Sam Raimi, or not visual gags, but like, yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's like Sam Raimi, did horror, like Evil Dead is a straight horror movie.
Yeah. That's true.
But Sam Raimi is mostly well known for his like comedy horror. And I don't think this isn't a comedy horror.
No, that's not what I meant. Yeah, no, you're right. But like even down to something leaning out of the mirror and choking you, and then the camera, they take a step back and they're choking themselves. Like it, like that's in Evil Dead 2.
Right.
like that's directly from that. Granted, it's not like a whole, you know, a wholly original Sam Raimi thing, but it made me think of that. And it feels like there's a lot more silliness, like frame tilted at 45 degree angle as we zoom in on something, like weird stuff like that going on. That couldn't help but make me think of Evil Dead or Sam Raimi. Mm. And I feel like this, while it does have the James Wan's insane ability to linger in a frame just long enough to get you really scared and creeped out, this movie also relies really heavily on jump scares, I think.
Okay. I think definitely that has some. I think this, I really like The Conjuring 2. I'll throw that out there.
Yeah, I did. Not that I didn't like it. I just felt like compared to the first Conjuring, it has an odd tone.
Okay. Yeah, I do think like The Conjuring 1 was built pretty much solely on atmosphere, like I said. I think The Conjuring 2 keeps that going, but it kind of takes the best of both worlds from the first Conjuring and Insidious, even though I didn't care for Insidious that much. Insidious was very reliant on jump scares, as was Insidious 2. And I think it kind of takes the silliness of Insidious 2, which that Insidious 2 I actually remember coming out of theater kind of liking.
I don't think I've seen the other two Insidious movies.
I've never saw the third one because James Wan didn't do that one, so I had no interest. But Insidious 2 was directed by James Wan, and that's a profoundly silly movie. Actually, I don't remember that much about it, but I remember that at one point Patrick Wilson gets possessed by a demon.
Okay.
And for like a half hour, Patrick Wilson is just like kind of gleefully being the evil guy for and it's the best. He's like,
that's kind of awesome.
He's doing like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, and it's great.
Nice.
But I think this kind of takes the silliness of Insidious 2, the jump scares of Insidious 1, and the atmosphere of The Conjuring, and kind of just puts them all together into one movie. And I think it pretty much works. You know, I think at this point, like, James Wan could direct a great horror movie in his sleep.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And, you know, Conjuring 2 is like right within his wheelhouse. And I don't think it's as innovative as the original, but I think it is a blast to watch. And, you know, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga return as Ed and Lorraine Warren, the real-life couple of paranormal investigators whose exploits are perfect for a horror franchise. Like, if you just look at their Wikipedia page, it's like, oh, yeah, that could be Conjuring 3.
Anything could be Conjuring, yeah, with these guys. And I do applaud them for avoiding Amityville, sort of. They, like, wink not, like, it's a big plot point.
Right. At the end of Conjuring 1, they imply that Amityville's next, right?
Yes.
And then basically Amityville is at the beginning of this movie.
Yeah.
And I think the way they did that was great. You know, it's based on, just, you don't know where you are. I mean, you kind of get that you're in Amityville, right?
Yeah, you don't know, it's just a window. Like,
That's the thing. You see the window and you're like, oh my god, it's the Amityville window! Like, and then it says Amityville.
That was really cool.
That was very effective because it's like if you know what Amityville is, that's an iconic image right there.
Yeah,
to play around with. But I admire that this movie wasn't just Amityville.
Yes,
you know, it did a different thing because
it could have fallen into that trap.
Because I was reading an interview with James Wan and he was like, well, yeah, there have been 14 Amityville movies, and so I didn't really want to do that. You know, it would be easy to do an Amityville movie.
And it would probably
be good. Like, it would probably be entertaining. With Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga as those characters doing Amityville.
Yeah.
But I like the way they did it, where they kind of, like, make Amityville kind of the beginning of the movie, have, like, the original vision being taken place there, and then everything kind of comes back to it at the end of the movie. But it has no real bearing on what's going on throughout most of the movie. It's kind of like a James Bond opening, you know?
Right. Where
it's like,
that's kind of exactly what it is. Yeah. And I do love that. And I think that vision that happens at Amityville that and then recurs throughout the film was like grade A. That was outstanding.
Yeah.
The spirit thing, demons.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I agree with you. I do think this movie is longer than the first Conjuring 2. Not the first Conjuring 2. The first Conjuring. This is the first Conjuring 2.
This movie is longer than The Conjuring, also.
Yeah, there you go. This movie is longer, and I think it's a little bit slower and a little more unevenly paced. But the thing is, it's all in service of character work. Usually it's like, there will be great horror moments, but there's a lot of scenes that are just the Warrens talking to each other, or the family talking to each other, or getting through what they're doing. And I think the pacing kind of drags a little bit as a result. But it's worth it because I think it makes it more emotional towards the end. Like I felt more attached to those characters by the end of the movie because of the time that it spent dealing with them.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree. And I think it's a little bit of a, like, the first Conjuring is kind of a typical, I don't know if that's right, but like a 70s Americana family kind of thing, like moving into a house for the first time and all this stuff. And this is where moving to a like destitute British family.
Yes.
And we get a lot of time to figure out what their dynamics are, what's going on there. And I think you're right. It does serve a good purpose to make us care about this family a lot. And that said, it's only 2 hours and 15 minutes. It's not...
Right, but for horror, that's kind of a long time.
That is a pretty long movie,
Usually horror movies are shorter because horror is kind of like... You know, it's a genre you get in, you get out. It's built on surprise, so if the surprise kind of deflates at any point, you're kind of screwed if it's super long.
Yeah, I guess I'm just... I'm used to every movie being 2 hours, 2.5 hours now.
Fair enough. It's post-X-Men life.
It's the post-X-Men life, yeah. Exactly.
Every movie will have an R-rated Ultimate Edition with a half-hour deleted scenes.
I can't wait. I can't wait for that future, Mike. Just kidding. It's the worst.
Worst possible timeline.
Worst possible timeline. And then another thing I wanted to just point out. This film, like I said, I did enjoy this film. I was scared. I think a lot of it was effective as a horror movie. But it does retread a lot of the similar things from Conjuring, or else, I mean, we get the single take through the house again,
right? But it's
which
so
I
good.
Think,
I think this I, one this one might actually be better.
Oh wow, I disagree. I thought this one was way worse than the first one.
Way worse. Wow. Why way worse?
I just feel like there's less going on. Which I mean, it's fine.
Okay.
The first one was so impressive because it lasts, I think, maybe longer. I don't really remember. But there's way more dynamic stuff going on because they're moving to the house.
I do recall that, yeah. But this one also, it's, I think, different because it's going through a window and it's like...
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad, I guess. Saying way worse was hyperbole. But I thought it was better the first time in The Conjuring. And then in Conjuring 2, it was like, oh yeah, this is happening again. but it is cool. It is a cool effect. And I like that James Wan does a lot of stuff like that in his movies. He does it in Insidious. I remember one of my favorite shots in that film is tracking people up a staircase, which was really in the house. Conjuring 2 has it. There's a death sentence with Kevin Bacon. There's a really long foot chase through a parking garage, which is all done in one single take, which is bad. It's really cool. So I like that, and James Wan, we gush over him every time we talk about one of his movies.
Right, yeah. We spent like an hour talking about Furious 7 when we first saw that.
Yeah. I love his directing, and I want him to do a lot more, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, he's doing more.
Yeah exactly.
He's doing Aquaman, which is like the one thing making me super excited about DC. Like, the DC universe, I think, is in a lot of trouble, but the fact that James Wan is doing a movie there, like, that's encouraging, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But all right, should we get into spoilers for The Conjuring 2, Mike?
Yes, there are some very specific things I want to talk about.
All right, let's do that. Let's get into spoilers for The Conjuring 2, starting right now. All right, spoilers for The Conjuring 2, starting right now. So the big twist in this movie is that the old man who's been haunting the family from the beginning is in fact not actually haunting the family, but is being possessed himself by a different demon. That's the one from the vision that Vera Farmiga was having throughout the movie.
Right.
Which genuinely I didn't see coming. And in retrospect, maybe I should have. Like, it seems like that's, it makes a lot of sense. Like, why else would that vision be happening? And why else would that demon be in the vision? If
right.
but it worked very well in the moment. And I thought it was really clever. Yeah. The last 20 minutes or so, the entire climax, I thought it was incredibly intense.
Yes, absolutely. From the moment on the train when they play that reveal was really cool with the sound tapes. And
the two different tape recorders.
The two tape players. Yeah. When they figured that out and they did that, it ramps up to 10 or 11 and stays there for the whole. And it was I thought that was really effective and really cool.
Yes. Yeah, and masterful use of like cross cutting, like cutting back and forth between the Warrens and the family and the demon, like just a lot of great stuff happening there. And the big thing about this was that the demon can be gotten rid of if you could say the demon's name, but the Warrens don't know the name, or do they?
No.
About halfway through the movie, Vera Farmiga has a vision about the demon's name.
Oh, that was a really creepy vision.
It was. It was.
That was really fucking scary.
It was, yeah. And she realizes that she knew the name the entire time. Like, she realizes she knew the name and had written it down, and she goes back. The brilliant thing about that vision, and I noticed it when I was watching it for the first time. Like, I saw those letters in the background.
Yes.
The demon's name is spelled out in the background of the scene.
It was so cool, though. It's done so well.
Yeah, it's, like, I just, like, the demon's name is Valak. Valak, whatever. And the letters that spell out Valak are like letters that are on the bookcase behind Vera Farmiga in the vision.
They're like bookends, but just kind of used on the bookshelf as decoration.
And they were so prominent that I noticed them. Yeah. And I thought to myself, huh, those are a couple of random letters to have in your bookcase.
Yeah, well, I didn't even...
I didn't think that much of it. Like, I was just like, oh, yeah, letters, whatever. Some people have letters in their house.
Did you notice the scene that it's in before that also?
Is it another scene?
Yes. So we have Patrick Wilson paints the painting of the demon, which is fucking weird as shit, and was like, why would anyone paint that?
and then hang it up in the house.
And then that's what I mean, yeah. I mean, painting that is fine, but then being like, this is good, and then like putting it up in your house. But then they walk into the kitchen out of the living room, and they sit down at the table, and on the windowsill, there's like paper cut like snowflakes and stuff. And hanging up on that string of snowflakes are letters that it's V-C-V-A-L-A, and then the K is off out of frame.
Really?
And I was like, oh, maybe. And then their daughter walks in, and I was like, oh, maybe their daughter's name is like Valerie, and we just can't see the whole thing. Like, because it makes no sense why that would be there.
Right.
And then the scene in the living room or the study or whatever where it's on the bookshelf, and I was like, oh, yeah, maybe it's the daughter's name still. I don't know what it could be. And then she says the daughter's name is like Jane or something like that. Yeah. And I was like, well, now I have no idea what this is. And then way later, it comes back, and I was like, holy shit, James Wan. Like, it was so
good. You did it. Yeah, that was insane. That was incredible foreshadowing. Like, it's one of those things. Like, it's brought to your attention in those scenes.
Absolutely,
and I didn't notice it. I didn't notice it during the snowflake thing. So good eye on that one. But I noticed it during the book, like on the bookcase. Like, it's right there.
It's definitely. I didn't realize it. I didn't until you just mentioned it. But it's the center of the frame because you're sitting on the couch in the left of the frame.
Yeah,
and the bookcase is right in the middle.
Yeah. And it's right there. And it's like that's so bizarre. And and it's one of those things. Like, I didn't think that much about when I saw it, but I noticed it.
Right.
And then when it came back, like when it's like, I realized, like, I know his name. I just have to find it. And then I remembered the letters and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. That it was a really cool moment and it felt really paid off. And cause that could have been a really like cheap out into her figuring out what the name is. But right. for some, like she literally shouts at the sky and it's like really, really over the top and hammy. But for some reason, having those letters that I had noticed made it feel like paid off to me as an audience member. So I guess that's why they're there. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think the standout sequence in this movie for me was when the Warrens are at the house. They had recently arrived. Mm-hmm. And they do an interview with the girl as the demon. Like, the demon yes. like, possesses her during the interview. And they all look away from her so that the demon will talk. And it's just this one long take, like one continuous shot, with Patrick Wilson right in the foreground of the frame. And like out of focus in the background is the girl.
Yeah.
And like as she's talking, she like transitions into the demon.
Yes.
But it happens so gradually that you don't even like notice it until you do.
Yeah, like, until it's blatantly obvious that it's the guy.
And it's like, holy crap. And it's very intense. And it's very scary. Yeah, that was a phenomenal transition. Like, that was just masterful.
Yeah, I thought that was really, really cool. I was like expecting it in some, not expecting how they did it, but I was like, oh, she's like kind of out of focus, and you can't really, you just kind of see a general shape sitting in the chair.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it'd be really cool if like the old dude came up from behind the chair, because he's out of focus. You wouldn't really see what's going on. You would just see like shapes. And I was like, oh, whatever. I don't know what they're going to do, but it's not that. It doesn't look like. And then all of a sudden, like, because you get the spirit gets angry and like shakes a little bit.
Yep.
And I was like, oh shit, the old guy, he's there.
Yeah. Like, what? You don't even realize the change happening until it happens.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Also, the Crooked Man sequence.
Yes, that's the Babadook.
It's basically the Babadook, which was effective, though like a little redundant if you've seen the Babadook. But literally at the beginning of the movie, you see like the two kids with the Crooked Man song and music box thing at the beginning.
Yep.
And they're like singing into it, and like you plays back the recording. And like as soon as they played back the recording, I was like, well, this is going to come back in some horrifying way later on.
Yeah. Well, it also lingers on the front image of like the Crooked Man.
Yeah.
That shows you like what it's called. It's like, this is terrifying.
Like, why would you buy that for your child?
Yeah. It also, I felt really bad because I don't remember what that's called, like that like style of like looking through slits as it spins, like to make the image move. I forget what that's called, but then when they show that and they see the Crooked Man walking, I was like, it's the Ministry of Silly Walks? Like what? Like it kind of undercut that for myself.
Yeah, but the sequence when I think it's the little boy, the Johnny, I think his name was, the little boy, like wakes up
Billy.
In the middle. Billy, whatever, wakes up in the middle of the night and like the like sees the dog barking and the dog turns into the Crooked Man.
Yeah,
like that was insane. That was crazy. That was
it was really creepy. But
it's the way he moves, it's like this weird like kind of stop motion effect. It's not, it doesn't look CGI creature.
No, yeah, it looks like he's made out of wood and it's really spooky. But that kind of that moment I keep saying Sam Raimi, but like that kind of weird horror comedy type thing going on, which for this movie in the opening crawl of them of the, like the start of the Enfield case calls it the most diabolical case the Warrens had, and then we get these weird like filmmaking horror comedy techniques like with the it kind of made.
I don't think it's taking like I don't think it's taking.
It's not playing it for laughs. It's not doing that.
Right. But I also don't think it's taking the cases of the Warrens that seriously. I mean, it's.
I like, guess not. Yeah.
I mean, like it's a based on a true story horror movie, but like quote unquote. But that basically means like this is a thing that people say kind of happens. Like the Warrens are the Warrens. Like,
yeah.
I'm not like, you know, the Warrens say like are real people, and they've said like these are all the things that we've done. These are all the cases that we've dealt with, and you can like look into these. And so many people are like, yeah, these are hoaxes, or these are like different things.
Yeah. Definitely.
So I feel like. There's a lot of liberties you can take with these stories in any case, which is why they're so popular to adapt.
Right. That's definitely true.
This kind of stuff.
Although it did save it for me. That sequence where I like the Crooked Man, the dog turns into the Crooked Man. Where I was like, really? Like it, cause nothing like that had happened that up to that point in the movie.
Right.
It was all kind of, I don't know. It's not stereotypical, traditional horror stuff going on, you know? And then the Crooked Man comes, and when Billy runs back to the living room where the whole family is, and he's like waking everyone up, and we're expecting the Crooked Man to come around the corner.
Right.
And it's just Janet.
Yes.
That kind of saved. I was like, okay, that makes like, it's actually effective because I was worried that all of a sudden this crooked man was going to attack the whole family and like they would all see the crooked man, which like kind of would defeat the kind of underlying plot of the movie. Yeah. Is it a hoax? Is she faking it? Right. But if like this weird 8 foot tall crooked man guy came around the corner, I would have been.
It'd be tough to justify that. Yeah,
it'd be like really silly all of a sudden.
Yeah, I also think this movie ends on a very lovely note.
It does.
You know, it ends with like, you know, the Warrens save the day. Everybody's happy. The Warrens go back home and they do a little dance set to Elvis Presley's "Can't Help Falling in Love."
Right.
It's very nice. You know, many horror movies would opt for the final scare in those last moments, you know, something like make the audience jump as the cuts the credits. And James Wan doesn't do that here. He instead goes for like a little moment of tenderness, which I appreciated.
Yeah. I did really like, we get a shout out to Annabelle, at the end.
Right. Yeah. She was just in the background of the scene or whatever, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not like a shout out, but yeah, we see the,
where she was in the first movie.
Yeah. But they made like a whole big deal out of the first, they made a whole movie about it.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, she was like the prologue in the first movie, right?
And then
there was the Annabelle. I never saw Annabelle, actually.
It was not that great.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard it wasn't good. But that's also not James Wan, so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point it out that it's in there, I guess. But what was I going to say? There was another thing there, Mike. And it's gone. Oh, well. But I did. Yes. I do agree with you, though, that the kind of humanizing the Warrens in some weird way, or normalizing, I guess I should say, because they're fighting demons, they're doing all this crazy shit. But at the end of the day, they're just a married couple.
Yeah, and so much of the movie is kind of just built on their relationship, and it's, you know,
yeah.
I think it does a really good job of showing you why they like each other, why they love each other. It's nice. It's just a nice little ending.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they have some nice moments each with Janet explaining.
Right.
Each of them have like a story explaining like how they met the other one.
Yeah.
That they tell Janet, and both of those are very nice. It's just a very nice time. So in between the horror, James Wan finds moments for humanity, which I do like. Yes. Did you want to bring up any other sequences, Mike, before we wrap up?
I feel like I did. Oh, well, the vision in the living room, which we've kind of talked about, or in the Warren's home when they learn the name of the demon.
Yes.
But like the second or the end part of that, when she's in like the office with the painting.
Yes, that was terrifying.
Oh my god. Just that was such a cool, I got two things now. That was such a effective use of like shadow and darkness.
Yep.
When the painting is right next to the light switch. So she has to approach the painting, and you see the like glowing blue eyes, or not even glowing, just blue eyes in the painting. She flicks the light on, and it's just a regular painting. And then like it happens a couple times, which was really fucking creepy.
Yep.
But then we watch the shadow walk across the wall to the painting, and then like form into a person out of the painting.
Yeah.
Which was really spooky, but it's also dragged me to hell. Where A shadow chases someone through the room across the wall. So it was just, maybe it's because I just love Sam Raimi so much, so everything is Sam Raimi to me. but it was another direct use of a thing that Sam Raimi has done, like the choking in the mirror thing.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, when is James Wan going to take stuff from Oz the Great and Powerful is the real question.
You know what, though? Like, I could totally see him doing a horror movie that has, like, a little China doll girl. Held together by super glue.
Fair enough. That's kind of what Jigsaw is, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Let's go with that.
All right. I did want to also bring up the scene. You know, there's several scenes of the kids getting tortured in the house. But I think the standout scene, and this is in all the trailers, too. I don't know if you saw the trailer before.
I did see the trailer for this,
The scene with the crosses. And all the crosses. Like, it's just an entire room filled with crosses, which is creepy in itself.
Right, which is enough to be scary.
Yeah. But that was the mom's fault. So she put those crosses in there.
Yep.
It's an entire room just filled with wall-to-wall crosses, and every single cross just slowly turning upside down.
Yes.
Is such a just an incredible horror visual. I think that's, like, fantastic. So I did want to bring that up, too, because that was really great.
But I felt like that was undercut with the trailer. Like, the reason I don't watch trailers anymore, or try not to, is that, well, that visual is really scary and is really effective in horror. But then the jump scare that happens at the end of it is in the trailer.
Right, yeah.
Like, the thing that steps out of the shadow in the corner.
Yes.
Like, but that's in every... we saw that in literally every trailer, so, like...
Yeah, fair enough. But, I still thought the moment was very good.
Yeah, no, that's true. I just wanted to get out of my soapbox about trailers for a second.
yeah. Also, we were talking about Ouija recently, right?
We were.
And, we were talking about Mike Flanagan directing Ouija 2, because he's been possibly directing Halloween.
Right.
And, you know, I said, like, I didn't see the movie Ouija, but it always seemed like a bad idea, because Ouija boards are just kind of like a fundamental building block for, like, a shitload of horror movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And lo and behold, there's a Ouija board in this one.
But I never really noticed this in other stuff. Is Ouija, it must be branded, right? Because if the movie is called that, they call it a spirit board in this.
And
maybe. I was like, oh shit, could they, like, is that something they'd have to pay for to be able to say Ouija?
That's possible. Although this was like an off-brand Ouija board, like it wasn't like...
I mean, it was something they had made, yeah.
Yes.
It was like on the back of a cereal box or something.
Right.
but I just noticed that they said Ouija, or they said spirit board. And it just pulled me out of it for a second. It was like, "That what? Like, that's a Ouija board." Like, and then I realized, like, "Oh shit!" And then here I go into this, like, I'm not paying attention to the movie. I'm thinking about copyright.
And suddenly, yeah, you're thinking to yourself, like, "The life of the creator plus 75 years? Are you fucking kidding me?"
Damn you, Disney! It's all Disney's fault.
That's the real horror, is copyright.
Oh my god, Valak is an allegory of copyright law.
It all makes sense now. Alright, I think that about wraps it up.
Yeah, I think we're out of stuff.
Film podcast today. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I stream our games at twitch.tv/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, letterboxed at mikesmithfilm, Instagram at meatsandwichwpdh. And a whole bunch of other stuff. You can also find our other podcast at filmbook.com. Thanks so much for listening to Film Bookcast. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us next week for a new episode of The Complete Works, in which Mike and I will be discussing Nicolas Cage's role in 1994's Secret Service comedy, Guarding Tess. And you can join us the next time we meet here in 2 weeks, where we're likely to be discussing one of these two movies. I'm going to let Mike decide right now.
Oh, boy.
Mike, do you want to review Finding Dory, the long-awaited sequel to Pixar's Finding Nemo, or Independence Day Resurgence, the long-awaited sequel to Independence Day?
Oh, man. Both? Can we do both?
If you want, I'll probably see both. So if you want,
I kind of want to see both. That's tough.
How about pick one? And if we can see both, we'll review both.
Okay.
Pick one we can review like that you would want to do. I think, like, Finding Dory, I think, has a better chance of being good.
Exactly.
But Independence Day could be a lot of fun to talk about.
It could be a lot of fun to talk about, but on the other hand, I don't really want to support Independence Day. But
yeah, but you just said you want to see it.
I know, but I want to see it. But, like, on principle, I also don't want to see it, because it's just like a shitty... I'm prejudging it. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know, man.
I don't know, but like a sequel no one asked for.
I believe screenings started today, so we'll find out what critics are saying pretty soon.
Okay.
Independence Day 2. But, I mean... Let's
say Independence Day.
Independence Day?
Yeah.
That's what you're going with?
Yeah. I feel like that'll be a lot of fun to talk about.
I hope so. Yeah. Are you a fan of Independence Day, Mike?
Am I an American?
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Yeah, no, Independence Day is one of those movies that's like, it's so dumb.
Yeah.
But I think it's just super enjoyable to watch. Then again, I haven't watched it in full in a very long time. It's one of those movies where I'll catch like half an hour at a time on TV.
On TNT or some stupid
Yeah, and I'll be like, hey, Independence Day. It's fun.
I missed the speech. All right, and then just keep saying it. Like, keep going.
Yeah, you watch if you tune in before the speech, you watch it for the speech. If you tune in after the speech, you switch to something else.
Exactly.
I used to have Bill Pullman's speech memorized, actually.
Somehow, I'm not surprised.
If you know anything about me, it's that I have Bill Pullman's Independence Day speech memorized, and then I know all the words to Hamilton.
And all the words to Hamilton.
And I'm going to sing the Hamilton to play us out. How does a bastard, orphan son of a whore, and a Scotsman drop
in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter by 14. They placed him in charge of a trading charter. And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up.